session number 16714, Rich Forbes, Reel 3.
Mr. Forbes, Reel 3. What duties did you perform in camp?
Well, as an officer, first of all, you had to see to your own platoon. So when you woke up in the morning, and your batman had brought you the normally cold water to wash and shave in, you had to get your own platoon on parade, which had been previously inspected by the sergeant and the corporal, to make sure that every man was properly dressed and correctly lined up for inspection, because later on, of course, all the platoon would be gathered together for an accompanying inspection. So that was your first duty, to make sure that the men were all right. And then after you'd had a good look at them, we'd break off and have our breakfast. Although usually, if the weather was decent, we'd get the men out first as well as ourselves and do PT. Again, as part of getting them fit in a short space of time. But the army always had one very good rule, which I think was very sensible. Nobody was allowed to do PT until they had a drink of very strong hot tea with plenty of sugar in. And once they got that down them, they were allowed to do PT. Because you see, some of the exercises for some of these men who hadn't been sort of really vigorously fit like we were, they found extremely hard indeed. But once we got sort of progressively through the camp, they found themselves getting fitter and fitter. But that was the rule, tea first, and then you get onto the gym. And then once we'd had the platoon looked at and paraded, we'd see what the daily orders were for the rest of the day. It might be platoon exercises on alone. It might be company exercises with the three platoons doing one in attack, one in defence, and one in reserve, that sort of thing. Or it might be rifle exercises, or if there's going to be a drill competition coming off in the future, we'd have to pick out the best men to form the best drill section. So we had to get to know each man individually, who is best at what, rather than sort of regard them as just 30 men with all blank faces, knowing very little about them. And then once we'd done all that, sometimes we'd have a general parade of the whole battalion, and We had another odd custom. The adjutant always used to appear on horseback at camp, and he used to ride on parade, and the colonel would hand over to the adjutant to get the parade moving. Then the adjutant would give his orders out on horseback. Then each company would march out and line up in three companies in front of the colonel and so on, and that's how it was. That was all the sort of formal part. But then if it was say preparation for doing field work, we'd take the platoon separately and we'd go through with all the, first of all, the section leaders and the sergeant, and then ultimately through the section leaders down to the troops, the sort of basic principles how to operate on a field of battle when under fire, just to get sort of a few basic principles of them. Of course, you've got to remember too that a lot of them, to sense, were, you know, uneducated men, and it was very difficult to get words in sometimes, and you had to use a lot of repetition and simplify so that they can understand, because even in wartime, even with educated people, unless orders are given out, very, very short orders, loudly enough for the other man to hear and simple enough for the other man to understand, you're wasting everybody's time. You don't want to go into all the negatives and positives, just giving simple, short and to the point. And that was the whole idea that we did with every part of our training. It was the same with stripping a rifle, for instance. You take part number one, you put your hand on that, you put it backwards one. You put it back forwards, you put it on hand number two. Well, you put it on hand number one, sir. And with that constant repetition, they eventually got to the stage where you could do these things nearly in the dark. So when they went out into the field, they knew straight away, they look outside in front of them, that's good cover, that section's on the left, he's going to go forward, I'm going to stay here, section on the right is taken reserve, and so on. And eventually this sort of information will trickle down into the minds of the men, so eventually you should finish up with quite a decent platoon. Still only a territorial army platoon, but never mind, quite good fighting material, and that's one of the biggest things these days, I think they should strengthen the Territorian Army and make them nearly at war readiness rather than we were. We were at war readiness to assent, but not good enough. But back to camp. And then, of course, we do exercises with other battalions doing the same sort of thing in the field. But basically, it was exercises within the battalion, very rarely called together because there was administrative disabilities as well.
What time would reveille be?
Well, I think it was 7. I think it was breakfast 8 o'clock and parade 9 o'clock, if I remember. 4 in A, 4 in B, 4 in every company. Then come to the cookhouse door, boys. But of course, the cooks would have to get very, very, very much earlier than that and get the meal ready. I think we had a fair amount of porridge, too. Porridge, bread, bacon, sausages, potatoes, of course, if it was lunch. And then we do the exercises in the afternoon. And then in the evening, it was, competitions of various sorts, talking to the men, informally talking to the men, finding out what their problems were. Officers would always dine in at night, of course. We had the band there for us. We had the band in one marquee, and we would be in the other band and in the other part, and they would play the nice soft music for us. It's a really good band, actually. But we had a really good time.
Did you have a morning break?
Yes, I think we broke off halfway through the morning. If we're on a route march, we always used to stop 10 minutes to the hour. Feet always had to be above your head to get the blood to run back. And then on the hour, off you went again. And it's a very good principle. And then perhaps halfway through the morning's march, we'd do perhaps a quarter or a half mile double march. You know, that really tested the men, because we all had equipment on, you see, and a rifle. And whilst in one sense we were better off, because we didn't kind of carry a rifle, we still had to carry all the rest of our equipment. But the men really had a hard time. But double march was the thing that really tried them out. But you see, it's a good preparation for wartime, because in wartime you don't say, well, come on, chaps, we better get moving and take your time. The enemy's only half a mile away. You had to get moving. So this is all preparation, though we didn't know it, for the real thing.
Did you have personal duties like mounting guards and
that
kind of thing?
We always had a mount guards, and the... each platoon would take a turn, you see. So if it was your guard duty, say, the next day, you'd pick your best men. You'd make sure that everything was absolutely spotless, including underneath your boots. In fact, I still used to do it. Underneath your boot sole always had to be polished. Because sometimes the guard would say, right, turn your boots up. And he looks underneath your boots, and if they weren't polished, right, there's a mark off for you, you see. And you know, even up till I, fairly recently, I still used to polish underneath my boots. Just for that little thing. But those little things used to count as a point, you see. Or it'd make you withdraw the bolt of your rifle, you see, and look down the barrel of your rifle. If there's any dirt in your rifle, it marks off for that, you see. So everything had to be absolutely spick and span. So if you know you're on guard duty the next day, you're allowed a lot of time off to get everything cleaned up, punched up, polished, dressing rather right, and so on, you see. So that occupied a lot of our time. But it was an honour to be chosen for the guard. Then, of course, the CO would come round and inspect you to see and, give you marks or tick you off. But, you see, it was aiming for a standard. That was the point. And although you used to grumble about it all, you still did it, including such things as I say, polishing underneath your boots, making sure the back of your buttons were clean and so on.
Did you still exercise stickman a reward for the smartest soldier?
I can't remember that we had anything like that. I can't remember my offhand. Not for the other ranks. They may have done other battalions, of course, and they may have had different customs.
Was it a 24-hour duty that you did?
Oh, yes, 24 hours. Then, of course, there's always the orderly officer on that day, and his duty was to go around the camp all the time to make sure that everything was tickety-boo, to remind anybody who had a report for a certain thing at a certain time, make sure there's no sort of... fooling on or disruption or drunkenness or anything like that. What was the car? Oh, housey was allowed, but nothing else. And language, certain words in language were not allowed if heard, let's put it that way. Swearing you had to ride with, but filthy language we would stop in their tracks, you know, to try and maintain some sort of standard. I know they don't do that these days, but I'm just telling you what we did.
Mine was quite a gambler. Was gambling a problem?
No, as I say, housey-housey was allowed, which I suppose was a form of bingo. And I dare say they had sort of gambling when we weren't looking. But if it was open, it was stopped. Because, from the young recruit's point of view, he could get dragged into something from the old sets of that. The same as we weren't allowed to treat in the menu for the same reason. It was the sort of tradition we had in the 9th Battalion. We were very fond of our tradition and pride in what we did.
What were the duties of the officer commanding the guard for the 24 hours?
His duty, there was always a guard tent, you see, because obviously the men were going out in the evening to look at the town. Well, first of all, he had to make sure that he had his guard on duty for the general camp. He probably posted a sentry at one point, another one at some other point. Then in the tent, he'd have probably a corporal underneath him, because he'd be the sergeant, you see, and perhaps a couple of other ranks. And then they would check each man out, where you're going. You've got to be back by so-and-so, you see, and take a note of his name and keep it on the register and so on. And every now and again, they'd have a patrol around the camp to see that everybody else that were in the camp was behaving themselves. And then, of course, when they came back, of course, he would check them in. And it was the orderly officer to go around the whole of the camp, and then every now and again, pop into the guard tent. Everything okay, Sarge? You know, anybody out that shouldn't be out, and all the rest of it, and so on. And that was part of it. And at the same time, of course, to see if the CO wanted anything special doing, or remind the adjutant about something, and so on. And there was quite a lot to do. And of course, you always wore blues on that duty, you see, at night. You always changed into blue uniform, blue patrols at that time. But when he had mess kit on, of course, for mess kit nights. But we had a good standard, and we wanted the men to feel that we're proud to be in the 9th for various reasons. And that, of course, is the thing that takes you through battle. That if you're proud of what you belong to, and things are getting tough, you'll stick together, whatever happens. And that's how Montgomery summed it up in his foreword to that history of the DLI, that he can always rely upon the Durhams.
And the men, as you say, would be learning the traditions of the battalion and the regiment.
Oh, yes, rather.
Combined.
I'd say every man had got this potted history of the battalion when he joined. So he got to know what they stood for.
What was the actual process of mounting the guard in 9DLI?
Now, let me think. Well, if I remember, the whole of the guard was paraded outside the guard tent, the position that is the main entrance of the camp, and they were all paraded and inspected, right? And then they broke off. There were two left with fixed bayonets. The rest of the guard went inside the guard tent, and then that guard either patrolled actually on the spot to the entrance or patrol round the camp with rifle and fixed bayonet, just to sort of keep an eye on things. And then when they'd done their turn, say perhaps an hour or a couple of hours, they would come into the guard tent, and two others would take their place. So there's always a constant oversee of what is going on inside the tent and what's going on in the rest of the camp. And also, ultimately, of course, to check up on those who should be in by midnight. If not, why not, you see? And then, of course, over-supervising all those, of course, would be the orderly officer, who would come along and say, everything okay, Sergeant? That's how it worked.
And might he appear during the course of the night itself?
Oh, yes. He was on 24 hours, you see. So he would go to his tent, lie on his bed, and perhaps snooze a bit, and then say, right, 3 o'clock in the morning, time to have a look around. So he would have to go round the camp, check on the sentries, because we also had sentries on duty, of course, check at the guard tent, see if anybody was in that should be in, and so on. So he was is really a 24-hour job. It was quite a job to do. And he was ultimately responsible to the adjutant, to the colonel, for what was going on in the camp.
What was the system of punishments for various misdemeanours that may occur?
Well, in territorial days, before the war started, there was very little apart from ticking him off and saying, don't do that again, if you'd be out of the battalion altogether. But there's nothing we could do. We could stop pay, perhaps. But there was really nothing you could do. And this is what I come back to, this question of respect for. Whereas once the war started, of course, it was quite different. You're under army regulations then. And well, I'll perhaps mention that later on. But before the war, there's very little you could really do apart from getting rid of them.
Were they good camps, the ones that you did attend?
Oh yes, we had a great time. Whitby, and particularly the one at Shilbottle, because we're really getting worked up there to quite a decent unit, and that's when we had our first experience of night patrolling, which was quite unnerving to start off with. To lose yourself in the dark, you didn't know where you were. But on the whole, we were quite a good battalion. We really enjoyed ourselves.
The behaviour and turnout of the men, was it first class?
It had to be, or else we wouldn't allow any sloppiness at all. Because you see, this discipline comes from the adjutant, basically. And the adjutant, Abdi Ricketts, was very, very strict, stern and precise. If anything was out of place, out of order, he was onto the company commander, like a ton of bricks. So that, of course, beetled down to the men, and they knew darn well if they stepped out of line, did the play on parade properly dressed, incorrectly dressed, did behave themselves, did obey an order, didn't act sharply enough, somebody would be onto them. So, of course, that seeped right through to the newest recruit. we had a very good discipline, program and reputation from that point of view. But there was no ultimate sanction apart from getting rid of them.
Was he a regular, the adjutant?
Oh, yes, they were always regulars. The permanent staff instructor was a regular, and the adjutant was a regular, and the regimental sergeant major was a regular. They were the three people that really did it, but the adjutant was the one that really controlled it all. He was a marvellous man.
Who was RSM at that time?
RSM Wilson, if I remember. Regimental sergeant major. I'll even describe a sergeant major to you. You know what they're like? They're all the same the world over. Tara. Tara SM. Barking out orders, some of which are obeyed, most of which are obeyed. But the actual man that did most of the drill and rifle work was the permanent staff instructor. He was very, very good.
Who was he?
Oh, I've forgotten his name now. PSA. It might come back to me. I can't remember his name offhand. I can remember the RSM, Wilson.
Was he an old soldier, Wilson?
He was a serving soldier. They used to have a system of, like, the permanent staff instructor doing perhaps a year or a couple of years with a TA battalion to act in that capacity as the chief instructors, and then they would go back to their own battalions. Oh, no, they're regular soldiers and non-NCOs. He was a sergeant major of the PSI, and the regimental sergeant was an RSM, of course. But, they're the ones that were very good and hot on discipline, the old regular army style.
Did training intensify as the war clouds gathered?
Oh, yes. You could see it coming, particularly the last camp at Shilbottle, which is in 1939, of course. We could see it. Now, the officers, particularly in 1939, were taken out on what we call TUTs, tactical exercises without troops. And this became very intensive. It was normally run by the adjutant and the colonel and the 2IC. And each weekend we'd go out. Usually we'd go out. Do you know Stanley at all? We used to go out to Stanley, and we used to pick a scenic plot of ground in front of us. And the adjutant, or perhaps the colonel, would set a scene for any machine post there, artillery 10 miles behind 10, infantry forming up there, farmyard here, woods also, A company of 9th Battalion on the left, C Company on the right, D Company in reserve, right, we're expecting attack any minute, what plans have you got to defend yourself? That was how it was done, you see. So we, young green officers, had to put our thinking caps on. Blasphemy. What have I got? Oh, yes, I've got a platoon here, three sections. Now, what do I do? If they break through that way with tanks, how do I stop them? Oh, no, they might come that way instead. But you see, it made you think. It made you recognize how to assess the area in front of you from attack and defense, what to do if this happened, and so on. And looking back, it's just very, very good training. Then, of course, when you've done all that, you then went back to your own platoon and did it on a smaller scale with them, perhaps in the corner of a field at camp, and say, right, we've got a field here, a bush here, farmhouse there, and so on. What would you do? And so, you see, and you get them thinking on the same line. So that if the worst, as I've said before, they were left on their own, they wouldn't be left literally on their own. They know what to do, and that's of course where the British Tommy always scores. He knows what to do, whatever the circumstances. So that's basically how we were trained. But certainly towards the beginning of the war, everything started to concentrate. That, of course, why the officers were sent to Sandhurst, to get them sort of brought up to date.
You said that 50 Deer became a motorised division.
Right.
Did that change your role in your training?
No, the training was exactly the same, except, of course, just before the war, they introduced the carrier platoon, which is the platoon I had, of course, which was designed to train us to move rapidly over bullet-slept country from one point to another. You see, what they found in the First World War, they probably had plenty of decent reserves here whilst this was all happening there. But by the time they got there, it was too late. So the army command said, we must have a motorised division that can move a whole division, fully armed and equipped, from A to B in a very, very short space of time. And that's how it became a two-brigade division. And, you know, we got the RAC ran the lorry side of it, and we were still trained as normal infantry. But what we had to do, of course, was to train ourselves to leap in and out of lorries at rapid speed, learn how to deploy quickly on the ground, assess the situation, and so on. But, of course, we couldn't do that until we actually got the lorries, because even the last camp, we had one vehicle, that was all, one Bren gun, one boy's anti-tank rifle, and that was a lot. And then every man had a rifle, but that was all we had. And this was the year the war started. It was absolutely appalling when you come to think of it, but there it was.
Your weapons then were the Lee Enfield rifle?
First World War, Lee Enfield, short magazine Lee Enfield. And then just before the war, they modified it slightly. But only slightly, but basically they just lightened it, that was all. They lightened the buttstock, they lightened that slightly. But even so, it was a very, very heavy weapon to carry, but a very accurate weapon if you knew how to fire it. And I can still remember the instructions that you give to every recruit as to how to aim a rifle. Get the tip of the foresight in line with the shoulder of the back sight, and if you did that, you were spot on target. And you see, you never forget it, so you rammed it home and you turned it down and time and time again so that in the heat of battle, they hadn't got to remember how to aim the rifle, they knew exactly what to do. And that's how we did it.
You say you were just getting Brens. What was the Bren like compared with the Lewis?
Oh, the Lewis was a dead loss. First of all, the Lewis, I would think, at least three times, if not four times the weight. The ammunition was held on a drum, which in theory was every time you fired a shot, it moved it round one shot and so on. Of course, the inevitable happened, the drum jammed. And secondly, it was air-cooled, but a very inefficient air-cooling. And of course, it used to get red-hot, and jamming was always taking place, so really it was a useless weapon. And yet, that was the standard machine gun in the First World War, apart from the Vickers machine gun, 0.5 diameter machine gun, which we had, incidentally, in our own battalion in the Second World War, the Vickers machine gun, which is a marvellous gun, of course, for overhead fire. That's what it was for. But we had our own machine gun platoon just before the war started. But then when the war started, we became underneath the umbrella of the Cheshire Regiment, which was completely Vickers heavy machine gun. So if you wanted machine gun support, you would call up the Cheshire Regiment to join, say, the 9th Battalion in this particular attack, you see. That's how it worked. But the Lewis gun was a complete dead loss. So, of course, when we got the Bren gun, it was like picking up something in paper. It was so light. And we thought it would never work, but it was a very, very efficient weapon. And, of course, it, as you know, invented and designed and made in Czechoslovakia. It wasn't a British gun at all.
Boys' anti-tank rifle you mentioned, what was it like?
Which rifle?
Boys.
Oh, the boys' anti-tank, a complete dead loss. It was one of these things thought of by some professor. It had a long barrel of about 6 feet long, and a very, very, it was high velocity, 0.55 diameter bullet, which in theory was supposed to penetrate German armour plating. In actual fact, all it did was to bounce off it. And of course, what happened was it had such a fantastic kick because of the high explosive bullet, it did more to upset the poor bloke that was firing it than the chap who was receiving the bullet at the far end. But we had to carry one on each carrier, and it went through a slot in the front of the carrier. Is it still a carrier at Durham, by the way? in the store. Well, that big gap in the on the left-hand side of the carrier, that's where the boy's anti-tank rifle was poked through. The theory was if a German tank approached you, you see, he just the chap was sitting beside the driver would look through and fire the rifle, you see. But it was a completely useless weapon. Then we had a rifle, of course, and hand grenades. And, of course, every officer had a Scott and Webley revolver with live ammunition, which we got just before the war started.
Was it an effective weapon?
Which one?
The revolver.
Oh, yes, very, very effective. We had to, it had a very, very big kick, and it was very, very effective indeed. It was, I think it was 4.5. And we had to do special exercises to strengthen our hands and arms, because every time you fired, of course, it tend to kick up, you see. So we had to do exercises. I can remember that, and down to strengthen these muscles here. So because we were trained to fire single handed, we weren't allowed to fire double handed, you see, because you had to carry a pistol at your belt, you see, and you also had to get out straight away and fire like that. Very effective weapon, but the boy's anti tank rifle, complete dead loss.
Mortars? What mortars did you have in the battalion?
We had a 2-inch mortar platoon, and then we could call up later on. There was a 3-inch mortar platoon, which would organise as a, I think they eventually became mortar companies, which you can call in. But our own battalion, for instance, the battalion was in action. We had our own individual 2-inch mortar platoon. You see, it was a very effective weapon. It was only a small thing about that high, but very effective for close work. But the 3-inch, of course, was for further ahead. You see, we're always years behind the Germans in weapon development. You know, we're looking back. I mean, particularly in tanks, we were completely, literally miles behind. There you are. So they were all the infantry weapons. Although, funnily enough, when we went into France, we went on this firing range at Le Touquet, I always remember, to fire all the weapons, including hand grenades. And one of the weapons that we were given was the Tommy gun, which Al Capone used to use to do his dirty work. And I had a shot firing that. And you're talking about letting off a blooming tornado. You just held this thing at hip level, pressed the blooming trigger. The next thing you know, you were trying to flatten yourself on the ground. It had a hit like a hammer. But that's what they used to do. They used to go around shooting each other. But we weren't hissing with the Tommy gun. That was just a bit of playing on.
So then you'd have the bayonet, of course.
Oh, yes. Well, we all did bayonet drill, of course. We did this in the drill hall to start off with. Then, of course, in the out in the field, and particularly at camp, we used to do a lot of bayonet drill at camp. It was a very, very important part of infantry training, of course, camp.
What did that entail, bayonet drill?
Well, you'd have a wooden frame, a canvas bag or a sack bag full of straw with a face on the top. You'd all line up, fixed bayonets, and you'd hold your bayonet, rifle and bayonet, at the port, it's called, right? Then the sergeant would shout out, "On guard!" And you bring the rifle down with the bayonet pointing that way. Then you say, "Charge!" And you had to charge, screaming your head off, and aim for the target. Then he would shout, "Withdraw, on port," and then retreat, you see. And then the other thing you had to learn was charge, dive in, withdraw, butt up for the second blow, back again, port, and run back. And whilst it seemed very silly in a way, in actual fact it was very, very good training for when the time came, because you learned how to go in fast and quick, in, out, up with your butt if need be, out again, and then run away again. And all this had to be done at high speed with a sergeant shouting his head off at you and making you run at the double all the time. It was quite exhausting. But that was bayonet drill.
And it was considered very important to learn to use the bayonet.
Oh, yes, it was. It was next to firing a bullet. You had to know how to handle a rifle with a bayonet on and what to do with it.
Did you have any gas precautions training?
Yes. Well, once the war started, of course, everywhere we went, we had respirators on all the time, and we all had to go through a gas chamber, as you probably know. You put your respirator on, went in the gas chamber, took it off, fell to the floor, gasping and choking, and went outside to make you realise that if you didn't wear it, what was going to happen to you? And then we learned how to do on the firing range with the respirator on, and wherever we went, we always had to carry our respirator on front of our chests. And when we went overseas, of course, we all had our gas cape on and our gas respirator. And also we had special gas first aid equipment attached to our equipment. So wherever we went, we always thought in terms of gas, you see.